Welcome to A Touch of Gray. My name is Vicki Duke, and I'm your regular volunteer broadcaster coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please remember that Sun Sounds is a member-supported service and bringing to you the literature of AARP. Today, we are starting in the February issue of the newsletter, Special Report, An Election Like No Other, by Dina Bunis. Brace yourself. The 2020 presidential campaign that officially started on February 3rd when Iowans go to firehouses, schools, churches, and meeting halls to caucus for their choice to run for president of the United States could well be one of the toughest and most rancorous contests in decades. Beyond the presidential sweepstakes, voters will have many decisions to make at the polls during the primary season and again this fall. All 435 members of the House of Representatives, 35 of the 100 U.S. senators, and 11 governors will be running, as well as thousands of state and local candidates throughout the country. But experts do agree that despite the old political adage that all politics is local, this is going to be an election year that is dominated by the presidential race. Down ballot candidates will have to fight for attention. If you like clean, positive, issue-oriented campaigns, you're going to be disappointed, said Glenn Roger, a partner at Public Opinion Strategies, a leading Republican polling firm. It's going to be rough and tumble. Celinda Lake, a veteran Democratic pollster, predicts that issues will only determine about 10% of voters how they make up their minds. About 40% of decisions will be based on character, and half of those who vote in the general election will cast their ballots based on party affiliation. After Iowa's first in the nation caucuses comes the New Hampshire primary on February 11th, the Nevada caucuses on February 22nd, and the South Carolina primary on February 29th. On March 3rd, Super Tuesday, 16 states and territories will vote. Social media's impact. Not only will communications from both sides likely reflect the deep political divisions that permeate the electorate, but the way the candidates communicate will be more personal and focused on platforms like Facebook, analysts say. This is the first post-mass media election in which, for the first time in U.S. history, more significant amounts of money will be spent on social media and digital than on broadcast, said Will Robinson, a Democratic consultant and founding partner of the new media firm. Robinson compares the transformation to that of 1960 presidential battle between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon. That election was the first one in which television was a major communication element. Kennedy understood the power of television, Robinson says, and many credit his performance in the first televised debate of that campaign as a key to his eventual victory. Ever since, the 30-second television spot and flyers mailed to voters' homes have been the primary communications tools of state and national candidates. No more. Much of the reason for this shift to digital is practical. The traditional ways of contacting voters just aren't working anymore. Broadcast television viewership is at an all-time low, Robinson says, and only 6% of Americans will complete telephone surveys, leading to the potential demise of political phone banking, which is another long-standing mainstay of get-out-the-vote efforts. At the same time, people are more skeptical about answering their doors to talk to a candidate or volunteer canvasser about politics. older voters still dominate. Analysts predict that 2020 will see a huge turnout at the polls. I think we're going to see a record high percentage of voters, similar to when the voting age was lowered to 18 in 1971. Bolger says it could even be a record turnout since women got the right to vote in 1920. What will remain a constant in 2020, experts agree, is the importance of the older voter. In the 2018 midterm elections, 53% of eligible voters turned out, compared with 66% of Americans 65 and older, as well as 60% of people ages 45 to 64, according to U.S. Census Bureau. In the 2016 presidential election, 71% of those 65 and older voted, while only 46% of those under 30 went to the polls. Nancy Lamon, the Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer at AARP, says the data shows that candidates are going to have to pay attention to older voters, and that means finding ways to reach out to them. Many older voters may not be plugged into the social media platforms that younger voters rely on for their news, political information, and that will probably mean investing in some traditional media, especially local television and newspapers. One of the most powerful trends of the 21st century is changing demographics, and public officials at all levels are going to have to come to grips with the myriad opportunities of having many more older Americans, but also the challenges, says Lamon. Experts also say that given the expected volatility of the 2020 elections, voters who care about issues are going to have challenged candidates to say where they stand. Older Americans disproportionately care about issues that other voters might be overlooking, said John Pitney, a professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College in Claremont, California. They're thinking about pensions and home health care and issues like the future health of Medicare and Social Security, which Pitney says aren't even on his students' radar. What's the best way to be sure that those issues are addressed? Show up, Pitney says. When candidates have forums, go to the forums. When candidates see a lot of older voters in the audience, they pay attention. When older Americans speak, politicians listen because they know older Americans vote. Social Security and Medicare are classic examples of programs that concern older voters more than younger ones, says Charles Franklin, the poll director at Marquette University Law School in Milwaukee. The advantage and clout that older voters have because of their high propensity to vote carries over in the reluctance of Congress to touch either of those two programs. Not only is turnout expected to be exceptionally high this November, but voters are engaging much earlier than usual. What we've seen in both state and national polling so far is that interest in politics generally and the professed likelihood of voting in the upcoming election are at unusually high levels. Our polling shows interest at about a level that we normally see in October, 2 or 3 weeks before the general election. There's an inset here about AARP and voter education. Whether it's discovering all the ways you can vote, learning where your polling place is, or finding out where the candidates stand on the issues you care about, AARP will be your guide to the 2020 election. AARP has produced a series of videos called Ask the Candidates, which feature Democratic presidential hopefuls on such important issues as the high cost of prescription drugs and the need to strengthen Medicare and Social Security. As the campaigns for president, Congress, governorships, and local offices unfold, AARP will provide updates on where the candidates stand, where you can go to find more information on their backgrounds and their positions, and how you can find town halls and other forums where you can question the candidates yourself. We'll be monitoring, in some cases, sponsoring debates among candidates at all levels and seeking volunteers to help get the word out on what races and ballot initiatives are important in your community. Voters can look for information in the bulletin online at aarp.org/election2020. And on Twitter, Facebook, and other social media platforms. AARP will poll voters over age 50 so that candidates will be clear on where older Americans stand on the major issues. What AARP will not be doing, endorsing or contributing to candidates. We'll give you the information, but you need to make up your mind. The next article is a question and answer with Carla Hayden. People Who Look Like Me Were Once Forbidden to Read. America's first African-American and female Librarian of Congress talks about its hidden treasures. You are the first woman as well as the first African-American Librarian of Congress. It's a small club, right? Answer: the first Librarian of Congress was appointed in 1802, 2 years after the library was established. I'm the 14th. The first woman is significant because 80% of the library workforce in America is female. And of course, a person of color is significant because people who look like me were once forbidden to read. Question: the struggle for those freedoms has meaning to you. Answer: Frederick Douglass talked about that in his autobiography. He knew there was something magical about reading because it was forbidden. Question: you got in some trouble reading too much as a child, right? Answer: I was attending PS 96 in Jamaica, Queens, and there was a small storefront branch library right across the street. I checked one particular book out so much I had to use my allowance to pay the fines. It was a learning experience. Question: you have plenty of books to choose from here. Answer: more than 24 million books. But then there are also lots of other items like diaries and maps. Question: tell me about some of the artifacts here. Answer: we have one of three known locks of hair from Beethoven. We have four locks of Thomas Jefferson's hair from different stages in his life. And we have Harry Houdini's files. Question: aren't there some Lincoln items found in an unusual way? In the 1970s, someone noted that behind that door, pointing to a door in the librarian's ceremonial office, there was a vault no one could remember being opened. Legend has it a prisoner who was a skilled safecracker was brought in, and he picked the lock and opened the door. There was one box inside, and that's where they found the contents of President Lincoln's pockets from the night he was assassinated. His glasses, a Confederate $5 bill, his pocket knife, some news clippings he carried, and so on. Those treasures had been unseen for a very long time, and it was an incredible find. Question: how do you display special objects? Answer: we're working on having, for the first time, a treasures gallery at the Library of Congress. We would put the Gutenberg Bible there. Then we would bring out some things people didn't know we have, like some of the first editions of the world's largest collection of comic books. We would be able to rotate these things in and out for the public. Question, what are the special exhibits here? Answer, we're in a year-long celebration of women's right to vote, women's suffrage. That exhibit takes advantage of the fact that we have the papers of Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Mary Church Terrell, and the National American Women Suffrage Association. That exhibit runs through next summer. Question, why do we have a Library of Congress? Answer, its original mission is still part of its mission now, and that is to serve Congress. It started in 1800 with about 700 books, mainly legal books, to serve the new Congress. After the British burned down the library during the War of 1812, Thomas Jefferson sold to the library his collection. It was about 6,000 books, and that was the largest personal library in the United States. It included religious texts, the Bible, the Quran, books in different languages. He said that there is no subject that the members of Congress should not have to refer to. That set the framework for future collecting. Question. Your first library job was in Chicago 46 years ago. You later ran a library in Baltimore. What drew you to that work? Answer, I love books and reading and knew what they meant to me. When I found out that there was a profession that could help other people enjoy reading, I thought this is really something that speaks to me personally. It was really a match made in heaven. And this interview was by Andrew Carroll. Next, we have a special report. It's the cover story, Ageism in the Workplace. Goodness. It's time to accept the last acceptable bias should end, by Joe Keita. About 35% of the U.S. population is now age 50 or older. Yet in 2018, the EEOC, the nation's workforce watchdog, issued a damning special report on age discrimination against older Americans. It concluded that even though 50 years had passed since Congress outlawed the practice, age discrimination remains a significant and costly problem for workers, their families, and our economy, says Victoria Lipnick, the EEOC's acting chair at the time, went so far as to compare it to harassment. Everyone knows it happens every day to workers in all kinds of jobs, but few speak up. It's an open secret. That same year, an AARP survey found that about 3 in 5 older workers have seen or experienced age discrimination in the workplace. 76% of these workers see age discrimination as a hurdle to finding a new job. Another report found that more than half of older workers are prematurely pushed out of jobs and 90% never earn as much again. Diane Huth's story is a prime example of this bias. I am 69 years old and have worked in corporate America for more than 40 years with big-name companies in branding, says Huth, who lives in San Antonio. But nobody takes me seriously for a job at my age now, even in things I had excelled at. Paradoxically, most companies do not seem to understand that older workers possess a depth of skills and knowledge that's worth paying for. People walk out of companies now with an enormous amount of intellectual property in their heads, said Paul Rupert, the founder and CEO of Respectful Exits, a nonprofit consulting firm that's raising awareness about ageism. Here are just a few examples before I move on. Number one is William Charles Blocker. He was 62. He claimed that older black employees at Saks Fifth Avenue were targeted for discrimination by their managers. Number two is Walter Mikulin. He's 64. Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, paid him a $1.15 million settlement after he sued, claiming he was fired for being too old. Number three is Nancy Sullivan, 74. On her behalf, the EEOC sued City Colleges of Chicago for refusing to hire Sullivan for a full-time faculty position due to her age. Four is Joseph Bednarik, 66. He settled an age discrimination suit against the state of Pennsylvania after he said he was denied a job for being too old. Number five is Pablo Orozco, 56. He sued Saks Fifth Avenue in New York, claiming his age and ethnicity kept him from getting promotions. Number six is Julianne Taff, 64. Joined Catherine Moon in filing an age discrimination complaint against Ohio State University. Seven is Liz Marco Weinman, 67, was verbally harassed because of her age by a client and a boss. Number eight is Floyd Cardwell, 65. The EEOC sued restaurant chain Ruby Tuesday on Cardwell's behalf after he was turned down for a job based on his age. Nine is Catherine Moon, 68, along with Julianne Taff, filed a lawsuit against Ohio State University that was settled out of court. Ten is Dale Kleiber, 63. The U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear his appeal in a lawsuit against a medical products company that refused to hire him. And finally, number 11, Brian Reed, who's 70, sued Google, which settled out of court after he said he was told he was let go for being too old. Moving on with the article, they know things that are essential to the company's success, and if that knowledge is not captured, that company is losing a tremendous chunk of capital. How did we get to this point, and how can we combat such widespread discrimination? To answer these questions, the AARP set out to examine workplace ageism from all angles, and here's what we learned. It's an accepted bias. If you haven't felt the pinch of ageism yet, experts say you probably will. Age discrimination is so pervasive that people don't even recognize it's illegal, said Kristen Alden, an attorney specializing in employee rights for the Alden Law Group in Washington. Like other biases and discriminatory practices, ageism takes many forms. In the workplace, it appears in three main areas: recruitment and hiring, when younger applicants are shown favor simply due to their age; on-the-job bias, where older workers get fewer training opportunities, promotions, or rewards, or are harassed; and finally, termination, when a company freshens its workforce and trims its budget by targeting senior employees. Rupert of Respectful Exits suggests that the problem emanates from our roots in free enterprise. The predominant U.S. business model is still an industrial one in which employees are seen as human capital, he says. Companies view their workforce the same way they view capital equipment. You buy it, you assume it has a certain shelf life, then you replace it with a new model. Stories like these are typical. When a couple of people I cared about experienced ageism, my reaction was, I'm not going to let that happen to me, says Patty Temple Rocks, who spent 38 years in communications and is the author of I'm Not Done, a book about ageism at work. But when it happened to me, I realized everything I had been thinking was wrong. I was still on my game, but was being moved into a non-essential role to make room for someone younger. I learned to structure my resume in ways so it's not obvious how old I am, says an engineering executive in his late 50s who asked that his name not be used. I would get calls. The phone screens would go really well, but when I went for interviews, I never hear back or be told someone else got the job. Eventually, I realized what they were thinking when I walked in. This guy isn't a spring chicken. These tales are easy to find. Between 1997 and 2018, approximately 423,000 U.S. workers filed for age discrimination claims with the EEOC. That's roughly 19,200 a year, and 22% of all workplace discrimination claims. But an AARP survey found that only 3% of older employees have ever made a formal complaint of age discrimination to a government agency or someone in the workplace. There are probably hundreds of thousands more who simply accept that situation. Unfortunately, we have come to the end of our time today. Again, my name is Vicki Duke, and I am your volunteer broadcaster reading to you from the AARP literature for my show, A Touch of Gray, and coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed a program such as Touch of Gray on Sun Sounds, you can listen to it wherever you want by getting it on demand. Go to sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio.